life without hope. Now that's living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. Bring me to hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I am your host for this podcast. You can call me first name Captain, second name Nostalgia. Please help me in welcoming from our friends over at Superhero Movie Cast, Mr. Thomas Olson.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while, but I'm glad to be here chatting with you today.
Yeah, it has been a while. We were talking about that before. It's like, I have like 2019 goals. Like I want to have guests that I have on more frequently than just like every 6 months. And you're definitely one of them.
Oh, thanks, dude. I always have a good time. And I liked your intro too. First name Captain, second name.
That was, I think, one of the most dramatic moments that in the movie. And if you guys haven't figured out, we are here talking about Glass today. So this is kind of like an unofficial crossover because we're going to be talking about the trilogy as a whole over on Superhero Movie Cast. We'll have a link in the descriptions below. But for any new listeners, what is basically in a nutshell Superhero Movie Cast?
Superhero Movie Cast is a podcast where we discuss superhero films. And sometimes we'll break off and talk other movies like Star Wars and stuff. But basically, yeah, we talk about the movies or various superhero films, why we like them, what maybe we don't like sometimes. And also we try to talk about some of the things that maybe we find inspiring that come from the film. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell. But it's, yeah, me and some friends, Josh, you've been on there many times, and it's just a lot of fun. So yeah, that's us.
Yeah. All right. And it is a show that I definitely recommend you guys checking out. If you guys like superhero stuff, if you guys like pop culture, Thomas definitely has a good atmosphere over there. And so if you guys haven't figured out, we are talking about Glass. We are going to be covering Unbreakable and Split later in this year. We had this big crossover planned with Invasion of the remake, and long story short, just schedules kind of got in the way, so we are going to cover it later in the year, but I'm so glad to have you with me talking about this movie, Glass. So I'm gonna kick it over to you, man. What were your general thoughts, no spoilers, kind of walking out of this movie?
Yeah, so I saw it last night, so we're recording on a Sunday, so I went to a really late showing Saturday night, and I came out just... I don't know. I was like, I need to process this, you know, and we haven't talked yet about our thoughts. So I'm excited to hear. I have no idea what you thought either. But the more I thought about it, I actually really like it. And I know a lot of people, I've seen stuff, reactions where the more people think about them, the more they don't like it. I really enjoyed myself as I was watching it. I was never bored. I was never disinterested. Some choices in the movie, I was kind of... maybe perplexed by or didn't totally love, but overall really liked it. It was a fun movie, and it's not perfect, but it was a great conclusion to this trilogy, I thought. So yeah, that was kind of my just brief reactions. I'm sure there's more, but I'm really curious to see what you thought of it though.
I'm in a similar boat to you where I look at this film and I can understand how people hate it. But I understand as a moviegoer, and I walked out of this film with kind of a little bit of, like, there were certain aspects of it that I really liked, certain aspects of it that I felt like they could have done stronger. And I was talking to a buddy of mine who was on our Titans episode, Josh Howell, about it. And I just kind of felt like this is a good conclusion to it, but it's not a great conclusion to it. Yeah. And so we'll kind of expand upon that. Like I said, like it is a good movie, but when you're comparing it to its predecessors in Unbreakable and Split, it's not a great movie of what it could have been.
Yeah, and I mean I think for me it was a satisfying enough conclusion. You know, I came away because I know Shyamalan, M. Night Shyamalan, the director, said he's not planning to make any more sequels. You know, this is, or spinoffs or whatever, this is it. And so for that, I was satisfied. But yeah, it's some of the execution though I didn't totally love how a lot of it was executed. That was kind of where I'm at right now. And it's still been less than 24 hours since I've seen it. So it is a movie that I'm still processing through a bit, but hope to be able to do that more with you today and get some more of my thoughts out. So.
Yeah. All right. So here's what we're going to do, because this film is still fresh in theaters. If you guys have not seen it yet, hit pause, run to your local cinemas, go see this film. And we're going to jump into spoilers on the other side of this commercial break. But if you guys are listening to this right now and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are over 100 suicides that take place daily on American soil. And when you scale back internationally, there are over 800,000 successful suicides. That is one death every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. Call the Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. You can text anonymously 274-1741, or even go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you can find even more resources past just those ones that we just gave you guys. The reason that we push this content that we do is so that you guys can know that tomorrow is always worth holding on for. So we're going to be back on the other side of this commercial break talking all about spoilers on Glass.
Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own.
Why are you doing that voice?
I don't know. I thought it made me sound cool.
It doesn't.
I'm Jason Bishop, host of the Invasion of the Remake podcast, with co-hosts Sam Stepanenko and Trish Coughlin. Join us each week as we rotate talking about your favorite films and their not-so-favorite remakes.
We'll also dig deep to find forgotten films that we think are more worthy of remaking, complete with our own fantasy casting.
You can get all 130 episodes and counting on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Music, TuneIn, Radio, Player FM, and all the best podcast providers, even
freaking YouTube.
For the low, low price of absolutely nothing, join the invasion. Subscribe today.
Or we'll blow up your planet.
All right, welcome back. The spoiler seal has been officially broken. Ha-da-ba! Glass pun. All right, so we are now talking in all spoilers for the film Glass. If you guys have not seen it yet, again, you guys have been warned. This is your official spoiler warning. But so this film kind of opens up, and we are kind of seeing where David Dunn is 19 years after the original. He's been called many, many names over the course of his career as a vigilante. They, I think they call him a total of 3 names within the first act of it.
Right. And then the Tiptoe or something like that was one of them.
The Tiptoe Man, and they settled on the Overseer, and then there was a third name that I don't remember off the top of my head, but just kind of seeing the natural progression of this arc from kind of where he was in Unbreakable, where he was not really willing to admit that Elijah Price was right, and then kind of by the end of that film, really embracing his superheroics. How do you think that the film picked up his story from where it ended Unbreakable?
I think that it did a good job, at least as showing you that he's been doing this for a while, and that this is his main focus in life, is being this superhero, the Overseer, or whatever. You know, I know he doesn't consider that his name, but I thought like they did a good job conveying that this is like his passion. You know, we find out that his wife has passed away, which was a huge plot point in the first film of their reconnection. And so, I thought they did a good job at showing that, like, you know, in the first movie, there's a big theme of like finding your purpose. And, you know, you can tell that he's settled into, he's been doing this for 19 years. He's very comfortable at it, very good at what he does. I think for me, like, I felt like they got that, but I also would have liked more of it, I guess, to see more of what it was like to see David Dunn in this role as like this superhero. I mean, because we don't get a ton of it because he gets captured pretty quickly and is put in a mental institution. So, but for the parts we did get, I thought that it conveyed a good, catches you up really quick. One thing I did love is that they have his son back in this. I thought that was a cool touch, and you got the same actor and everything back here as basically a sidekick, which I really enjoyed that part of the film.
And I that was going to be the first thing that I actually jumped into about his arc. I loved the use of Spencer Tree Clark, who plays his son Joseph in this film. They are not only business partners together with Dunn Security, Home Security, sorry, but they are also, he's kind of like the overseer is basically Batman, and then you have his son being like Overwatch. No, sorry, wrong mythology. Oracle or Green Arrow and Overwatch. You really have that awesome dynamic. I thought that it kind of brought, it carries the level of continuity and like the depth of believability, because if you look at Unbreakable, he is, the two of them are there when Elijah Price drops this revelation to David. Then he's kind of over there. That one of the best scenes in Unbreakable is when he's lifting the weights.
Yes.
And he's putting them slowly back on it. And he's just like, you know, how much did you lift? And 350 pounds is what he lifted. And he's like, oh, I could have done more. And I loved how, and at the end of that, they have that moment in Unbreakable where he tells him that, you know, he was the superhero, he got to save this family. It just seemed like the kind of the natural progression is that they would grow into this relationship together. And I felt like that, to me, was almost one of the most natural parts of this film, that you would have the two of them not only go into business together, but go into security of all things, but also at the same time to have each other. You know, you have one that is Oracle, and then you have the eyes. And I thought that was such a great progression of their character bonding arc from the first film into this one.
Well, I think it's cool too, because it embraces superhero mythology to begin with. You know, every superhero, even the ones that are, you know, quote unquote solo superheroes like Batman. I mean, obviously Batman expands, but even in depictions where Batman is solo, even say like the Dark Knight trilogy, he still has Alfred that's helping out behind the scenes, and he's got Commissioner Gordon. He's got people to rely on to help in his crusade. And I like that, David has his son, and that, it, like you said, it expounds on that really great dynamic from Unbreakable, and then, but also brings in this superhero mythology of like the sidekick. And one thing that's cool is, like, you know, David Dunn's colors are green. He's got his green poncho, and I noticed in this film that his son is always wearing a green jacket in most scenes, and so it was kind of cool to continue that theme of like the color schemes as well, just like, you know, with Elijah Price's character Glass, he has the purple. His mom is his kind of side supporting character in his story, and she always has purple as well, you know, throughout her wardrobe. And so it's just a cool touch that I really appreciate about these films and how they add in that element of superhero mythology.
I think too that I'm kind of curious if what you're taking on this is, there's a scene where the three of them are gathered in like this bright pink room, and Ellie Staples trying to basically explain why she's there. And she starts with David. She's like, you know, your wife died 5 years ago. But she also has this moment with his son, Joseph, where, you know, she again brings that up. Do you think that this bonding experience and this bonding arc really began to expand when you had them, like, after Audrey dies?
Like, are you saying, like, their bond became closer after that?
Like, did it start there, or did it start there, or did it start at Unbreakable? Like, what do you think?
I think it probably started at Unbreakable, because throughout that, like, he's a lot of his big moments, like the, like you're talking about, like, the scene with the weights or whatever, his son's usually there. And then he's also the one that is basically, like, pushing David to embrace this part of him. You know, like, he has a gun on him at one point. Sorry, we're giving spoilers for Unbreakable. I'm guessing people have seen it, but 19 years old. But yeah, at one point he's that desperate to have him embrace this role. So I would think that that bond would have started when they were young. Maybe he didn't always tell him about everything, but it probably got, you know, they probably got closer, especially after the mom passed away.
And I think that, I think that when you're talking about the bond between David and Joseph, it works bringing it forward into this day and age, where the opening sequence where, you know, Joseph is going through all the media and he's basically telling him about the latest overseer news. And, like, I really like those dynamics. But it's when it's after David gets caught by the police and he is brought to Raven Hill. That is kind of where the use of the Joseph character, I felt like, really kind of became baggage for the film. I feel like he had a purpose in the first arc, and then kind of that purpose dissipated as the film grew on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, yeah, he doesn't really... He comes back towards the end, and I think, for me, he serves a purpose towards the end, but I think just David Dunn's character in general in the middle of the film and his arc kind of... It almost, like, comes to a stop for a bit. I mean, there's the scene with all three of them, which is a great scene, like you said, of Ellie Price. Is that her name, Ellie Price?
Ellie Staple.
Ellie Staple. Oh, yeah, Elijah Price. Ellie is she's like, you know, talking to all three of them. That's a great sequence. But, like, yeah, I mean, David kind of just will pop in. And that's the thing I had about this, is, like, this movie, I think, is trying to be an origin story for Elijah Price's character, Mr. Glass. But, like, Samuel Jackson doesn't have any lines until, like, halfway through the movie.
And yeah, I would even dare to say that he doesn't have a line till almost the, probably, like, almost, like, end of the second act, almost teetering on the third act.
Right. And so the movie, that's the hard thing about it. I think that's where, like, some of the faults come in, is that it's trying to be his origin story, but you also are trying to show us, okay, well, we haven't seen David Dunn in 19 years, so what's he doing? We also have the Horde, James McAvoy's character, and we want to find out what he's going on. So there's not really a focus, like a central focus on one, whereas with Unbreakable, we had David as the main protagonist, and then we get the Horde story, where the balance was, I don't know, never fully comes together, I think, in a way that was really satisfying for each of these characters to have a very substantial arc. Now, they do have them, and they, to me, they mostly work, but I think it could have worked better had there been a more central focus in the film. And like you said, because we get this great intro with David and his son and this great dynamic, and then it's kind of just left to the side for a while. We come back to it. And so, yeah, that's where I think some of the seams of this movie kind of show, and it falls apart a bit.
But kind of jumping back into the direction of the film. So after this big intro with the overseer, and they're back at Dunn Home Security, where Joseph has been trying to coordinate the location of the Horde, where these guys, where Kevin actually is. And I love that they actually opened with the character of the Horde. Like, that to me, I felt like was really satisfying, because, like, where they had left these both of these characters at the end of Split. Like, Split was essentially the origin story and the character study of Kevin Crumb, who becomes the Horde and simultaneously gives birth to the Beast, the high priest of this DID disorder, if you will. And he is it's Hedwig in the beginning, correct?
I think, yeah. Uh-huh.
So, like, they've established that he is going to that he's basically going. And have you ever actually?
I was just gonna say at the end of Split too. The horror basically establishes that Hedwig, Dennis, the kind of OCD version, the character, and then Miss Patricia are gonna be the ones that share the light. Those three. And so yeah, that's how the movie starts. Is we get a taste of those three characters kind of from the beginning, because those are the dominant personalities that are shining from now on.
Have you ever seen the alternate ending, the original ending to Split?
No, I didn't know there was one.
So there's an alternate ending where he just kind of Shyamalan felt like it was a little bit too dark to leave it in there. So they brought it out and reshot the original ending that is in the film. And basically it's Dennis is sitting on top of a roof and he's just overseeing this high school where I'm assuming these cheerleaders are from. And he's like, look at them all down there, all that waste of potential, the unpure, and just, you know, kind of their whole thing. And then it just ends like black screen. So like, to me, it felt really methodical, and it kind of allowed you to get inside the brain of Kevin and the Horde and explore that. And I felt like that's kind of where they started this film for that character, was choosing the unpure, those that hadn't basically experienced pain yet, the virgins, if you will, kind of embracing that horror trope. And I don't know, as a horror fan, because I think the two of us disagree on the genre of horror as a whole.
We disagree on it.
Like, well, I really
I'm just
like
not a huge fan of it. Yeah. I mean, I any horror movie that I usually watch, well, that's not true. I don't watch a ton, but the ones I usually do are come from recommendations of people that are like, this is a good one, you should watch it. And so I usually enjoy those, but I don't go out and watch every horror movie like I would like a superhero film or a, you know, some other genres. So I think we probably do maybe, or, you know, you're a big horror fan. I'm more of enjoy it here and there.
Kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah. But I kind of felt like the introduction of the Horde, and kind of, I really liked it that they opened up the film, because you not only got to see kind of where he's been, because Joseph establishes that it's only been 3 weeks since the events of Split. So between Split and Glass, it's only 3 weeks in that universe. I really enjoyed the fact that we got to kind of see the methodical nature of these characters back and forth. And I kind of wish we would have gotten a little bit more of kind of McAvoy's character before, because I don't know. Like, I have like contradicting things in my head where I both enjoyed the parts of Ravenhill, but then there's also part of me that felt like it kind of came too soon in the film.
Yeah, I think it probably came too soon, and I think it stayed too long. Like, because the first act really is super short, and we jump into the second act, which is the bulk of the movie in Ravenhill, and I think that could have been edited and condensed a bit more. We could have got more in the beginning, because I agree. I think McAvoy stuff, and I mean, his stuff in Ravenhill is still really good, though. Like, I think McAvoy is just such an amazing actor. I was watching my wife and I, we saw a clip of, like, he was on the Stephen Colbert show, and he's got, I think it's Irish or Scottish. I can't remember which accent it is, but he's a very strong, natural accent of Irish or Scottish. And but like, for him to change that, to go from an American accent to a British accent, to being a little kid, to being a woman, and like, just to do that on the spot, like, is just so amazing and so fun to watch. But yeah, I like the way it opens too. I thought it was great to catch up with him. I actually rewatched Split. I was kind of running late, so I went to the theater and I literally had my phone and my headphones and I was watching it in the theater in my seat, literally like up, and it ended 2 minutes before the preview started for Glass. So it was cool to just go from that, because it had been a while since I'd seen Split all the way through. So I went straight from that into this movie, and it literally felt like the movie was still going, like a great continuation. So like, I thought that was a really strong part. But the thing I was going to mention, though, that I liked about this movie, about his character, that I liked maybe even more than Split, was that the conflict between the multiple personalities was really strong, and I like that different personalities had different character arcs throughout. I don't know, did you pick up on that?
I did, and that's really one of the, I think that also too with Split, you were able to, the way that it ended, there was this emotional connection that had been established between Kevin and Casey that I want to talk about in just a little bit, because that was probably one of my favorite portions of this film.
Yeah, but I've got some thoughts too, so I'm excited to talk about that.
I felt like there was, I loved the arcs for just everyone, and Hedwig I think kind of had the best arc, because yeah. there's a moment where Ellie's talking to Hedwig and she's trying to understand how the light works. She's trying to understand who gets the light, when they get the light, and she's trying to bring back Kevin. In an attempt to do that, she meets Hedwig and she's like, so you're nine forever, right? And kind of like the way that she words it, like she kind of depresses him, but then Mr. Glass really restores his faith when he meets Hedwig for the first time. He's like, well, you see the light, and or you see the world in this pure light, this light that very few people can see. And I loved his arc of just kind of self-assurance throughout the course of it. But also you also had you know, Patricia and Dennis, just they as very prominent as they were established by the end of Split, I feel like they had the strongest arcs of the personalities in this film.
Yeah, they definitely do. And I think that's smart to carry those over, because they were the big strong ones. But I just want to quickly point out, when McAvoy is Hedwig and he's in the beginning in the film and he's walking on the street when he bumps into David Dunn, like just his mannerisms, like to get this like young little boyish mannerisms are so good. Like his acting is just, it's so much fun to watch him do all these different personalities. And I like that we got to meet some new ones as well. Just, you know, even if it was for, you know, 10 seconds, it was fun to kind of, but one thing that I think Hedwig, I agree. I think his was one of the strongest ones. And I also really liked the arc that Dennis goes through, because Dennis really does begin to doubt the Beast. He's the one that is like, no, this is crazy. Yeah. And I think at the end of the movie, when he's dying, he's like, you know, he kind of embraces like how insane it was for them to go down this road, and to even give the Beast the light to begin with. And I also just love how in character he is as he's dying. There's blood everywhere, and he's like, oh, we got to clean this up, or he says something to that effect. Like that was a great, great moment in that film. And then also Patricia, I thought was interesting, because she does start to question the Beast a bit, you know. Ellie kind of gets in her head, but then she later comes back around and she wants it known that she never questioned. She wants to be seen as this, like, for her, she has this need to be seen as this faithful woman that stuck to her beliefs and her core and, you know, her values, and she never wavered. And even though she kind of does for a moment, and I thought that was really fascinating too, to see how all these different personalities go on their own journeys throughout this film was really fun and fascinating to watch.
I think too, the one thing that they established in Split was that each one of these personalities, like, they had their own body language, but they also at the same time, like, kind of had their own mannerisms. They would dress a certain way. You know, Barry was the fashion designer. You had Dennis that was always the very straight-laced, pressed pants, pressed shirts. And then you had the very modest Miss Patricia. And I think even McAvoy is really strong in this. He may be the strongest of the three actors within this film, just because he takes what he established with the personalities, and they're very distinct, but he brings body language within it. And there are times where you'll have conversations before he is even opening his mouth to talk, and you hear the voice, you can tell that by the way that he stands, that that is Patricia when he has his hands over his neck and he's trying to be very modest. You can tell that when he crosses his arms, and there's kind of this very relaxed but yet very intense stare, that this is Dennis. You can kind of tell when he's goofy, you can tell that it's Hedwig. And then they kind of do explore several other personalities. Jude is another one, if I remember that correctly.
Jade?
Jade, one of the girls. Yeah. Which
I think the new one in this film.
No, she's not. She was actually in Split. Okay. She's in Split in the specific scene where Casey is exploring the personality diaries.
Oh, the videos. Yeah. Okay.
So I really enjoyed that he was able to bring distinct body language and body movements to each personality, not just specific voices.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's one thing that's just makes it the performance so much fun to watch. And it's really cool to see when Kevin shows up too, because in that first movie, when the first time in Split, when we first meet Kevin, he's asking Casey to kill him because he's realizing what's happening. But I liked in this one too, like how his arc is he's afraid to take the light because he's got so much trauma in his life and so much, you know, fear that he is afraid to be the one in charge because he doesn't think he can do a good job. The others have convinced him that, no, you need to hide while we protect you, because that's, you know, that's their defense mechanism against the trauma that he experienced as a kid. And I love that in the last moment of his life, he kind of embraces the light and is like, yeah, no, this is okay. You know, like this feels good to be in the light. And so that was really cool to see. And so I don't know if you want to get into this yet, but the dynamic with Casey, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. I don't know if you want to save that for later or not, but.
No. I felt like Shyamalan drew a lot from the DC canon with some of the arcs that are in this, because if you look at Casey and the Horde, it's very much a Joker and Harley Stockholm Syndrome arc.
Yeah.
There is a lot of the arc that of Mr. Glass, Elijah Price, has very much this almost Joker, like Joker from The Dark Knight Returns meets Lex Luthor kind of dynamic, and I want to dissect that in just a little bit, but I really found the dynamic between Kevin and Casey really appealing and interesting, and it was probably one of the most compelling portions of this film, especially how they kind of opened it, because when you're watching her arc throughout Split, she is basically a sexual assault victim, and she's at this experience with Kevin and being kidnapped, it brought her to tell the authorities and put her uncle away, so she's now in a foster home, which is a big character development, because you know she lived with this long before her father died, so she had all of these years of baggage and shame that she had felt, and that experience really opened it up. And I thought that it was really compelling that they chose to kind of make that the starting point for how the two of them interact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think with her character, just to really quick to go back to Split, even like you said, is in that movie she's been through assault or sexual assault, like you said. She's experienced terrible things happening to her. These other girls haven't, and so she's always a bit more reserved in the way that they react to you know, the Horde in Split. Like the other girls are more reactionary, they want to attack him, and she's always more reserved. And what I think was interesting was she she started to understand the different personalities, and she could see that they were distinct people, and that if she was able to get through to one, maybe she could affect the others. And Kevin, in that moment, you know, you mentioned the Stockholm syndrome thing. When she meets Kevin and Split, the way I interpret it is like she develops that empathy for him. She realized this is the real person, and all these other people have taken over. So she's like, let's find the real identity in this, or the primary identity, and let's work on helping him. And so I guess I kind of went back and forth. I was watching this with the Stockholm syndrome. Like I didn't love that, but that at the same time, the way that they were executed was really strong. Like the moment when she goes and meets Kevin again, and they're like holding hands, and she's like trying to kind of motivate him, was like, I honestly kind of felt the emotion of that. And then it was great. You have a great moment afterwards when Hedwig comes back and she's like, wait, were you holding hands with him? With Kevin?
Wait, you like Kevin now?
Yeah, it was great. But anyway, so I guess, and then to have her be the one that is comforting him in the end, I'm like, as a, you know, just the whole Stockholm syndrome thing, like I didn't love that, but at the same time, it was her about trying to rescue Kevin. And is that her role as a victim to try to do that? Absolutely not. But I think for the story, they made it work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that she, the way that I looked at this is that I feel like you have your primary characters where you have Ellie Staple, David Dunn, the Horde, and Elijah Price, and then your secondary characters where you have Elijah's mom, you have Casey, and you have Joseph. I felt like out of all the secondary characters, she definitely had the strongest arc.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And I felt like it was a different side of her. So they did a really great job at taking the David and Joseph characters and evolving them and pushing them forward from where we saw them in Unbreakable, where you had the Kevin Crumb character. I felt like they did a really good job at just kind of bringing him over from Split, you know, because I don't know how more developed you can get than what he was established in Split, but I felt like you were able to move the Casey Cook character forward, and I really, really love that. I think that one of her primary one of her primary scenes within the climax of the film is where she is trying to emotionally reach Kevin and rationally kind of get the beast out of the light and speak to Kevin to stand down. I loved that scene. I thought that was probably one of the strongest, if not the strongest scene in the third act.
Yeah, I agree. And I think too, like, her character, to just continue a little bit about that, like in Split, she's, you know, she's very like standoffish to the other girls. She kind of lacks confidence in a sense. And it's almost as the way I guess I interpret it and her character in Glass, it was almost as if this experience, she experienced one traumatic experience as a young girl, and then she had this other traumatic experience as a teenager. And that taught her almost that she can be resilient, that she can work through these difficult things. And she walks more with confidence when we meet her in Glass. Like the first time we see her at school, and she seems more securely attached being in a foster home. And so she's able to go in and engage with Kevin. I mean, and you think about like when she goes to try to bring Kevin back to the light, and then the SWAT teams ends up shooting him. I don't think she was going there necessarily to try to go and forgive Kevin and say everything he did was okay, but just to, or the Horde, I guess I should say, but really just to try to, she felt like using more violence was not going to be the way to solve this problem of stopping Kevin, but getting to him emotionally, like you said, was the way to help bring Kevin back out to the light, to really help this person and these personalities kind of come to a more fitting a way to de-escalate the conflict rather than using more violence.
And I think too, like it was able to really bring more depth to Kevin, because like I said, like I felt like Split did such a good job at character development and the character study of who the Horde is and all of these personalities, but it didn't really tell us who the primary person is. And we got to really explore a lot of that within the context of this universe, within this movie. And that emotional connection to Casey was something that I felt like they juggled really well. As busy as this film can be at times, it does have those quiet moments where you are able to elevate these characters, and the Kevin Casey climax or arc throughout the course of the film, I think that they did that really well.
Yeah, and Anna Taylor-Joy, she's a great actress too, one that is very emotive and really good at connecting to her emotionally. And like, I think for me, the strongest moments in this movie were her beats and also the stuff with Kevin. And so that surprisingly was, I was kind of going to this more excited to see, you know, Bruce Willis back as David Dunn and Samuel. And while I did enjoy their performances and I thought I did like their stories, I that was the strongest part of the movie, was Casey's and Kevin's story arc. So those are the ones that I gravitate to.
But I think that outside of her connection to Kevin and kind of how she relates to him emotionally, there comes a portion throughout the course where she is trying to better understand the practice of Ellie's like specific psychological study and like why she, like, practice. And so she gets into like doing comic books and stuff like that. And like, I don't know, like that kind of arc was an interesting way to go, but it wasn't necessarily something I felt like we needed to see, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I didn't really think too much on it. I think it's always cool to see them bring comic books into these movies, like this series specifically. But yeah, it did feel like it was trying to harken back to, sorry, my series trying to talk to me. but I like harken back to what they did with Unbreakable, and maybe, yeah, it was a bit unnecessary at times in this film because we already got a lot of that in that film.
But then you have Elijah Price, who is this is supposed to be his movie, to where this trilogy, I think, is one thing that they've done really well, is you have the hero story in Unbreakable, you have the villain story in Split, and then you have the like an amalgamation of this massive showdown that is going down. And I sent you this article Screen Rant wrote, where originally Unbreakable was supposed to be one film, to where you have David Dunn is the hero, but then you also have the arc of the villain being the Horde, where you have this guy with DID, and they go head to head together, but he opted up to kind of explore these characters. To me, I feel like this trilogy as a whole, the arc for Elijah Price reminds me of, like I said, the Joker from Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns, where he's almost kind of comatose when we meet him, and it's not until he realizes that David's here that there's something within him that's awoken.
Yeah, no, totally. I definitely got that vibe, and which was cool. I thought that worked, and you know, but I guess at the same time, though, I wonder, though, like, I mean, he must have known. I mean, they present him as this very smart, capable person that, you know, if David's been doing this for 19 years, even if he's locked away in a mental institution, he probably would have known David was out there doing all this stuff. I mean, and that's at the end of Unbreakable, you see that finding David made him feel whole and brought him purpose. And so, like, I guess I thought that worked, but at the same time, I felt like if he was really truly the arch enemy, he would have been out there long before engaging in trying to this conflict of good and evil with David sooner, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and he kind of even talks about it in the climax, or I guess in on the heels of the climax where he's finally pitting these two together, where, again, it felt like something out of... I think one of my biggest complaints about this film is kind of the way that they... is the ultimate arc of Elijah Price in this film. I just feel like it's kind of one of the massive missteps of this film, where he really proved himself in Unbreakable, and he's really smart within this, but I feel like it's stuff that we've kind of already seen when you look at the one guy, like the one foreign guy, I can't remember the guy's name, Baron something from Captain America Civil War, where he's trying to pit Iron Man against Captain, and then you have Lex Luthor in BVS, where he's trying to pit the Man of Steel versus the Dark Knight. He's constantly looking for someone to reach David's full potential, and what is more full than a guy that can literally repel bullets?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I never made that connection until you mentioned it. But I actually really enjoyed his character arc, and I enjoyed the twists and the turns of how, like, you know, you make it seem like he's planning this big showdown for this new building, but then it ends up being he was like smart enough when she said we've upped our cameras throughout the facility, and how he took advantage of recording that and being able to send it out to, you know, the three different important side characters of the film. I actually really liked that. I thought that worked for me. And it was kind of fun though to see him finally become like you said, this mix of the Joker and Lex Luthor. I thought that's a really good way to describe him, of how, like, when the one of the nurses comes in to check on him, and he just slices the guy's throat just super fast. And so, like, he can be dangerous when he makes it so that you think he's, you know, you know, you're out of harm's way. And then that's when he strikes and takes advantage of that. And so, like, he's not only a threat, he can be a threat physically, while that's not his strong suit, but he is the more mastermind. And I like that they use a lot of that misdirection, which, you know, is kind of Shyamalan's, you know, MO at this point of using misdirection. But I enjoyed it. I don't know if it's like the most creative thing to do, but I thought it worked for the most part. I was satisfied with it.
Yeah, and I think that when you kind of have that twist is kind of where it went from being just okay to being wow. That twist with it's an origin story where you're basically telling the world about the people of, like, the Horde and the Overseer. I really enjoyed the completion of the arc, but, like, the journey throughout it. Like, I guess I just it felt tiresome to me almost.
Yeah, that's a really good way to explain it, is that the journey was a bit rocky, but the final destination worked. And a lot of times it's the opposite. And in the movie, when he says this is an origin story, when Elijah Price states that, I was kind of like, I guess so. I hadn't, but it was what he's speaking of is the origin story of these super being people, like, that they are finally going to be given the light of day, that people will, the mainstream population will finally know about them. And I thought that was a very satisfying ending to this series as a whole, as how, like, these small isolated events have been happening, but they've all been in the shadows, they've all been hidden, and now finally people will know about it. And even though our three main characters all die at the end, their legacy will continue on, and others, and for me I guess the way I see it is, like, others who have these powers will now come out, and, you know, they'll have the courage to come out and show themselves. And this secret organization that Ellie is part of has finally been defeated. That's kind of the way I see this film ending and the message it's trying to send.
And so with this film also, we got the kind of deleted footage that had been on Disney's cutting room floor for 19 years, bringing back footage from unused footage from Unbreakable, I felt like wasn't really a shock to me. Like I felt like they kind of built up the where Kevin's dad went. Like to me, like as soon there's a scene in Split where he goes to a train station and with flowers. So I feel like you can kind of make the connection, but I really enjoyed the scene between David and Joseph where he comes in to check on him and he's talking to him about, you know, I could have lifted more. And he's like trying to rationally explain this power. Like it's this very powerful moment between a father and a son. And it's kind of where he's sitting outside of Ravenhill trying to convince him that this dad's not really the superhero. I really respected the footage that they used for it, but for the Joseph, the Dunn duo connection, but not so much like the kind of like build up of his dad.
Are you talking about like when it shows him in the train and then we pan over and we see David for, okay.
Yeah.
I figured that they had shot that new footage and then they just kind of merged it with the old footage. So the scene though with him and his son, that was actual deleted scene.
That is what I've read. I would
assume so because he looks just like the kid. So,
and like if you look at even there's a very distinct look that I feel like cinematically Unbreakable has that as you're watching it, you can very much tell that it has a very, I don't want to say like buzzy color palette, but there's a lot of darker colors that are used in that, so it has a very distinct look, very similar to some of how Scott Snyder's work or like Tarantino, like directors that have a very distinct look. Unbreakable has that very distinct look and feel to it, so you can tell that very much when you are watching those scenes.
Right. Yeah, I like both of them. I thought it was cool to see. And I mean, I think the connection was pretty, I mean, it didn't come right out and say it like it does here in Split that his dad was on that train. I mean, you can go in hindsight, you can go back and get that from Split, but they just confirm it here. But one thing you were talking about was like how there's like the theme of, you know, Joseph, he's trying to explain to Ellie that, oh no, my dad's not a real superhero. And then you've got that whole sequence with the three of them where she's trying to convince them that they're not superheroes or that they don't have these real powers and that it's all coincidence or sleight of hand type things. And then there's this line that I felt like ties in this whole theme together really well, where Elijah and the Horde meet for the first time. And Elijah's says everything extraordinary is easily explained away. And yet it's true. And it's just, I thought that was really fascinating because I think that works on a lot of different levels just in our own real world, is that there are a lot of extraordinary things that happen and yet we can probably always find a reason to explain them. You know, like whether that's even, you know, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of examples of it, but that doesn't mean that those things still aren't extraordinary, just in the same fact that like these characters' superpowers, like they could be explained with logic or science. There's a way to process it. As human beings, we like to know everything and how it works, but yet that doesn't take away from the fact that these are still extraordinary things happening and these are still impressive gifts that these characters possess. And that was really, that really was powerful to me when I watched this, and just a reminder that there are, you know, like even if, you know, we can have an answer for something that's really powerful in our lives, that doesn't mean it's still not important.
Agreed, very much so. And I think that is probably one of my favorite moments within this film is, and I think that it's something that extraordinarily, like, I think we have this, like, hopes for big spectacles that we want to see a man walk through fire and live, come out unharmed, or we want to see someone swallow a sword or survive a bullet wound, or, you know, we want to see the most extreme when it comes to the extraordinary. But I think that even when you are suffering with something like depression or anxiety, the fact that you can get up and do your life, I think is a very important thing to keep in mind, is that even in the little things, you can have the extraordinary as well.
Yeah, no, that's very well put. And I think, yeah, just to add on to that, like if I think when you, yeah, like when just using that same example of like depression or anxiety, like also to recognize that experience is still real and still valid, even if science can explain the how and the why of it, that doesn't take away from that person's experience of those feelings and emotions. And on the same time, on the flip side of that, the positive and the happy or the joyful experiences or emotions that a person experiences, those are also just as real to them as well, even if it's being produced by, you know, like there's a way to scientifically dissect that and prove it. But so my point is, though, is that our emotions and feelings, regardless, are important. That then we need to make sure we're in tune with them, and give validity to those feelings and emotions, and not just let them be, not just disregard them because we can logically explain them or think through them. Does that make sense at all?
No, it does. Yeah, okay. And I think that just by putting belief in something, I think is a hard thing in and of itself. You know, I've said it on here many a times before that, like, you know, I am a man of God, and you know, I think I have a lot of people that are in my life that believe different things, and when you talk to them, they're, I think one of the most cliche questions that I've heard people get asked, you know, if you're God's so good, then why does famine exist? Why do natural disasters exist? Why do bad things happen? And it's, I think we, again, that goes to the extreme. It's like, well, people die every day by suicide. People are having crippling anxiety, that so much so that they can't be in social circles. It is hard for them to go to the grocery store or to go get their mail. And I think that you just the extraordinary is something that I think we experience every day. And you waking up this morning was extraordinary. The fact that we are recording in two different time zones, probably over 2,000 miles away, to me, I think that is just extraordinary that we live in an age where you can be friends with someone like that, where you can just shoot a text message or give a high five or whatever. It is just an extraordinary and a technological marvel at the same time.
Yeah, and yet all those things could be explained away as something insignificant, but at like you said, at the same time, I mean, it's like, Josh, you know, our relation, we became friends, what, like 6-7 months ago through a Facebook group, and you know, we've podcast together, and we shoot back messages, you know, all the time, and it's a pretty amazing thing that like we've never met in person. And you know, I don't make it out to the East Coast very much, so I don't know when that will be, if we ever meet in person, but we can still be friends, and that's a pretty extraordinary thing, like to have that, and that there's these small, simple, extraordinary things that happen to us on a daily basis is really powerful. And I felt like that was one of the messages that I took from this film.
No, I fully agree, and I think that another extraordinary thing about it, like to harken back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago with the Kevin and Casey thing, here you have people that have been through two completely different tragedies in their life, but yet somehow they found each other. And I think support is one of the deepest things that you can have. You know, we became friends over something as simple as a movie and a hobby like podcasting, but what has really sustained, we've had lots of people on this show, but I think that what really sustains relationships are being vulnerable with people and making those connections. And I think that the connect, like we talked about, it's one of the strongest arcs in the film, but I think it's also one of the most valuable lessons to walk away from this film, with that, you know, we all have baggage, we all have brokenness, but when we let our guard down, yeah, it's scary and terrifying, but at the same time, like, there can be something good that can walk out of that, and something amazing and extraordinary that you can't put into words until it happens.
Yeah, and to just piggyback off that with this film too, if you think about like the relationships that are formed amongst the three main characters, those are all actually probably unhealthy relationships if you break them down. You know, like David Dunn and Elijah's relationship probably isn't the most healthy, and then Casey and her relationship with the Horde, that's something that's not going to be healthy long term to sustain. But what I think is really interesting is that these three side characters end up, you know, Elijah's mom, Casey, and Joseph all end up forming a connection together, that those have the potential to be strong, healthy relationships that they could carry forward and be there for one another through this very vulnerable and trying experience. And so that was also kind of a really cool thing to see, as these three people united together to carry on after the death of these people that they loved ones for some, and others that were just a more tragic, impactful experience on their life.
Yes, totally agreed. And so if you guys are listening to this right now and you guys need direction, need resources, go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you guys can find those resources. And even ask to, like, join our Facebook group, where you guys can just meet other people that have been through depression, been through anxiety, and we just embrace life together. It's called Hope Culture. I just come out and hang out. But a couple more things that I want to address with Glass is this twist ending with the tattoos and this secret society. Like, I walked out and I was like trying to research, like, did I miss something in one of the previous two entries? Like, what is the connection between these films? And there's like no connection whatsoever. And I still don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah, that's one thing that I would have liked to have gotten something a bit more. Even maybe just a name. I don't know. Yeah, it did seem like, I thought the same thing. I'm like, wait, is this, were those in Unbreakable? I was like, I just watched it the other night. I don't remember those, you know? So yeah, I totally agree with you. And I don't really have much answer outside of they're just a secret organization that stops superheroes, I guess. Or so I would have liked a little bit more on that as well.
I think I was talking to Josh Howell from the Fear Saga after walking out of this, and we kind of differed on it, but he was talking about like how it's almost kind of like the government trying to basically contain this like supernatural element that is being unleashed into a world, similar to like Area 51, Black Dahlia, stuff along those lines, that like there are portions of our history as Americans where government just doesn't want us to know. And it's been speculated about what that is, but that was kind of like that organization, like that, like the Brunch Club was kind of this organization. Like, I don't know, it was, again, like I still feel like it was, I felt like the twist with Elijah was good enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think we still needed that, because we needed, well, yeah, I guess you, maybe you're right, maybe we didn't totally need this whole secret organization. But do you think, though, I guess the thing that I had was, what was your thoughts about them all dying, all three of these main characters?
I was okay with it, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, didn't really need to happen like that way, because like all three of them dying, like, to me, I understood Kevin dying, but to me, I didn't understand why David had to die. And I didn't understand why Elijah Price had to die. Elijah had been completely okay in Ravenhill for the past 19 years. Why now? Like, well, what is the difference now?
Yeah, and I think I agree. I think so. Kevin was probably necessary, but as I was thinking about it, because I was really shocked that David died, because he's supposed to be our hero, you know, the one we root for. But this movie, it really isn't like it's not totally even about him. I mean, obviously it is, but he's not the main, like I said before. But I think the point that I think he was trying to get across was like, all these characters are they're just a part of this greater battle of good versus evil. And it's about keeping a balance. And so it's not necessarily about one person triumphing over the other. It's about the constant battle that's always going on. And in that battle, there's going to be casualties on both sides. And so I think his vision, and maybe I'm reading in this different, the wrong way, but the way I guess I took it was that it's all of them died as a way to kind of keep the balance. And so we didn't end up with just this one triumphant hero like we would normally see in most superhero films, you know, where, you know, Superman defeats the villain and he's the last one standing. You know, that's typically how it works. In this, it was like, no, they're all going to die to even the playing field again. I don't know. That's kind of my take on it.
Well, I think that, you know, the more that I think about it, like Unbreakable and Split are both like so grounded in such real circumstances that you kind of needed that to, like, if the events of Glass went down in the real world, like, I feel like that's how it would go down, is to where all of the heroes and all of the villains needed to die to cover it up. Because Ellie talks about at the end, where she's kind of meeting with the secret organization, she's like, I finished my work here, I want to go on to the next city. So it kind of almost implies that she has made a career of studying people like this and then convincing them otherwise, that they are not superheroes, and if they comply, then they're let go. If they're not, then they're held captive
or killed. Yeah, that's true. So that's, yeah, and that, so that makes me really appreciate the ending a bit more, especially as this being a conclusion and a final pinpoint in this story of just, this is where it ends, you know. And so I think I actually appreciate a lot more as we've discussed it. So
one thing I'm going to say before we as we're kind of winding down too, is I really liked how the little note of the footage kind of going back to the East Rail 177 as they're boarding, and Kevin's dad is looking out the window and he's waving goodbye to them, but then he pulls out a pamphlet for DID. So it's kind of implied that he is trying to figure out what is happening with his son or what might be wrong with it. It's a little like throwaway moment, but I think that if it didn't happen, I think we wouldn't have gotten the events of Split. And it's like Elijah says at the end, he's like, you know, what are the chances that Kevin Crumb's dad and David Dunn would have been on the same train? And, you know, I made you, basically, is what he's saying. You know, I made you, gave you this brokenness so that you could live with your mom, and that the Horde and all of these personalities could be made.
Yeah, and it is kind of interesting too that, like, his whole life he thought his dad abandoned him, when really he was going to try to do something to try to help his son, you know, and help him learn to live with this struggle he had. And then, like you said, Elijah creates both the Horde and David, and it's a kind of a cool way to tie it all back together.
Yeah. All right. So is there anything else that you wanted to kind of hit on before
we close down? I think we covered a lot. Yeah. I think we got more, even more than I was thinking. So yeah, I think I'm good.
All right. So out of a scale 1 to 5, where does this rank for you?
Oh man, this is a hard one to rank. Like other movies, it's easier to come out and say like, boom, this, I don't know. I feel like the more we've discussed it just in this last hour or so, like, I actually think I like it more than I did coming into our conversation. I think we touched on a lot of really cool, interesting ideas and concepts, and I don't think we were too negative on the film. You know, we didn't go into too many of our gripes. And so for me, I think I would give it a 4 out of 5. And I think coming in, I was more at about a 3.5. So, yeah, it's got some, some weaknesses and some downfalls and things like that, but it's still a really great time at the movies. Like, I was very entertained. I was never bored. And it made me think a lot about a lot of different things. And so for that, I'm going to give it a 4. It's going to bump it up to a 4 for me.
I am actually going to keep my original rating. When I walked out, I sat in my car and I wrote my review for our website. And I'm going to go ahead and give this a 3 out of 5. I feel like they have really strong character dynamics. But I think that when Shyamalan tries to go broad, he just kind of goes way too broad. Like, I feel like the more intimate aspects of this film, I feel like they are the strongest portions of this film. I felt like overall, as an arc throughout the course of this film, I feel like Bruce Willis, James McAvoy, Samuel L. Jackson, Anya Taylor-Joy, I think that they turn in fantastic performances here. But I think that there's a lot of the third act is very, very clumsy. It's very sloppily kind of put together. But also at the same time, like, a lot of the secondary characters are, they try and establish kind of like these emotional connections, and he just kind of doesn't do it all that well. Whereas I feel like Unbreakable and Split, they were very intimate character portraits. And this one, I think he just kind of swung a little bit too wide and caught some good stuff and also caught a lot of bad stuff too.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, I mean, I would agree with that. I think just for me though, some of the emotional beats and some of the I don't know, just some of the deeper messages and meanings of this movie maybe pumped it up a bit as we discussed it. But yeah, regardless, I think people should check it out if they're interested in this series at all to see how it concludes.
Yeah, I definitely think that it does a really good job at concluding what Split and Unbreakable established. I think one of the things that when you look at both of the predecessors, there are two completely different tones, where you have like the super heroics in the beginning, but then you also have the kind of horrific nature of Split. And I think that Shyamalan really does marry the tones really well together, where you do have the super heroics and you do have the horror aspects in this one as well, but you also have those, like I said, those character moments are really strong within this film. But just as a whole, like, where they're placed within the film, they just kind of feel really weird in certain spots.
Yeah, you know what, I'm going to change my ranking. I'm going to give it a 3.5, so not much. But just there are some really clunky parts, like when one of the caretakers meets Mr. Glass and the Beast in the hallway. Like, that death scene is just, I don't know, like, really clunky. And so, yeah, and some of the things you said, yeah. So I'm all 3.5. I'm sticking with that. So
all right, so that'll actually give us a 3.25 out of 5 altogether. So be sure to check out Superhero Movie Cast. Where can people find it?
You can find it on iTunes or Apple Podcast, Stitcher, pretty much anywhere you listen to iTunes. You can also find us on Facebook, or you can email me at superheromoviecast@gmail.com.
All right. Well, if you guys have seen Glass, hopefully you guys have seen Glass if you guys have made it this far. Make sure that you guys let us know what you guys think, what was your favorite part, and so on and so forth. Leave us a comment below wherever you guys listen to podcasts. You guys can find us everywhere, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, iTunes, and YouTube at Victims and Villains. If you guys like what we stand for, you guys can also consider checking out our Etsy shop and becoming a Patreon supporter, where for as little as $2 a month, you guys can actually dictate what content we produce. But that's actually going to do it for us hanging out. Until next time, remember to keep talking nerd, talking hope, speaking nothing else, and remember, you are extraordinary.
Culture, artist owned, fan supported.